Chapter 22. Gilgamesh. That it will never come again is what makes life so sweet. Emily Dickinson, poem number 1741. In this time, heralded expansively as the dawn of a new age, burial in space was an expensive commonplace. Commercially available and a competitive business, it appealed especially to those who, in former times, would have requested that their remains be scattered over the county of their birth, or at least the mill town from which they had extracted their first fortune. But now you could arrange for your remains to circumnavigate the earth forever, or as close to forever as matters in the workaday world. You need only insert a short codicil in your will. Then, assuming, of course, that you have the wherewithal, when you die and are cremated, your ashes are compressed into a tiny, almost toy-like bier, on which is embossed your name and your dates, a short memorial verse, and the religious symbol of your choice. Choose one of three. Along with hundreds of similar miniature coffins, it is then boosted up and dumped out at an intermediate altitude, expeditiously avoiding both the crowded corridors of geosynchronous orbit and the disconcerting atmospheric drag of low Earth orbit. Instead, your ashes triumphantly circle the planet of your birth in the midst of the Van Allen radiation belts, a proton blizzard where no satellite in its right mind would risk going to in the first place. But ashes do not mind. At these heights, the Earth had become enveloped in the remains of its leading citizens, and an uninstructed visitor from a distant world might rightly believe he had chanced upon some somber space-age necropolis. The hazardous location of this mortuary would explain the absence of memorial visits from grieving relatives. S.R. Haddon, contemplating this image, had been appalled at what minor portions of immortality these deceased worthies had been willing to settle for. All their organic parts, brains, hearts, everything that distinguished them as a person, were atomized in their cremations. "There isn't any of you left after cremation," he thought, "just powdered bone. Hardly enough even for a very advanced civilization to reconstruct you from the remains. And then for good measure, your coffin is placed smack in the Van Allen belts, where even your ashes get slowly fried. How much better if a few of your cells could be preserved? Real living cells with the DNA intact." He visualized a corporation that would, for a healthy fee, freeze a little of your epithelial tissue and orbit it high, well above the Van Allen belts, maybe even higher than geosynchronous orbit. No reason to die first. Do it now, while it's on your mind. Then, at least alien molecular biologists, or their terrestrial counterparts of the far future, could reconstruct you, clone you, more or less from scratch. You would rub your eyes, stretch, and wake up in the year 10 million. Or even if nothing was done with your remains, there would still be in existence multiple copies of your genetic instructions. You would be alive in principle. In either case, it could be said that you would live forever. But as Haddon ruminated on the matter further, this scheme also seemed too modest, because that wasn't really you, a few cells scraped off the soles of your feet. At best, they could reconstruct your physical form, but that's not the same as you. If you were really serious, you should include family photographs, a punctiliously detailed autobiography, all the books and tapes you've enjoyed, and as much else about yourself as possible. Favorite brands of aftershave lotion, for example, or Diet Cola. It was supremely egotistical, he knew, and he loved it. After all, the age had produced a sustained eschatological delirium. It was natural to think of your own end as everyone else was contemplating the demise of the species, or the planet, or the massed celestial ascent of the elect. You couldn't expect the extraterrestrials to know English. If they're to reconstruct you, they'd have to know your language. So you must include a kind of translation, a problem Haddon enjoyed. It was almost the obverse of the message decryption problem. All of this required a substantial space capsule, so substantial that you need no longer be limited to mere tissue samples. You might as well send your body whole. If you could quick freeze yourself after death, so to say, there was a subsidiary advantage. Maybe enough of you would be in working order that whoever found you could do better than just reconstructing you. Maybe they could bring you back to life. Of course, after fixing whatever it was that you had died of. If you languished a little before freezing, though, because, say, the relatives had not realized you were dead yet, prospects for revival diminished. What would really make sense, he thought, was to freeze someone just before death. That would make eventual resuscitation much more likely, although there was probably limited demand for this service. But then why just before dying? Suppose you knew you had only a year or two to live. Wouldn't it be better to be frozen immediately, Haddon mused, before the meat goes bad? Even then, he sighed, no matter what the nature of the deteriorating illness, it might still be irremediable after you were revived. You would be frozen for a geological age, and then awakened, only to die promptly from a melanoma or a cardiac infarction about which the extraterrestrials might know nothing. No, he concluded, there was only one perfect realization of this idea. Someone in robust health would have to be launched on a one-way journey to the stars. As an incidental benefit, you would be spared the humiliation of disease and old age. Far from the inner solar system, your equilibrium temperature would fall to only a few degrees above absolute zero. No further refrigeration would be necessary, perpetual care provided, free. By this logic, he came to the final step of the argument. If it requires a few years to get to the interstellar cold, you might as well stay awake for the show and get quick frozen only when you leave the solar system. It would also minimize overdependence on the cryogenics. Haddon had taken every reasonable precaution against an unexpected medical problem in Earth orbit, the official account went, even to preemptive sonic disintegration of his gall and kidney stones before he ever set foot in his chateau in the sky. And then he went and died of anaphylactic shock. A bee had buzzed angrily out of a bouquet of freesias sent up on Narnia by an admirer. Carelessly, Methuselah's capacious pharmacy had not stocked the appropriate anti-serum. The insect had probably been immobilized by the low temperatures in Narnia's cargo bay, and was not really to blame. Its small and broken body had been sent down for examination by forensic entomologists. The irony of the billionaire felled by a bee did not escape the notice of newspaper editorials and Sunday sermons. But in fact, this was all a deception. There had been no bee, no sting, and no death. Haddon remained in excellent health. Instead, on the stroke of the new year, 9 hours after the machine had been activated, the rocket engines flamed on a sizable auxiliary vehicle docked to Methuselah. It rapidly achieved escape velocity from the Earth-Moon system. He called it Gilgamesh. Haddon had spent his life amassing power and contemplating time. The more power you have, he found, the more you crave. Power and time were connected because all men are equal in death. That is why the ancient kings built monuments to themselves. But the monuments become eroded, the royal accomplishments obliterated, the very names of the kings forgotten. And, most important, they themselves were dead as doornails. No, this was more elegant, more beautiful, more satisfying. He had found a low door in the wall of time. Had he merely announced his plans to the world, certain complications would ensue. If Haddon was frozen to 4 degrees Kelvin at 10 billion kilometers from Earth, what exactly was his legal status? Who would control his corporations? This way was much tidier. In a minor codicil of an elaborate last will and testament, he had left his heirs and assigns a new corporation, skilled in rocket engines and cryogenics, that would eventually be called Immortality Incorporated. He need never think of the matter again. Gilgamesh was not equipped with a radio. He no longer wished to know what had happened to the five. He wanted no more news of Earth, nothing cheering, nothing to make him disconsolate, none of the pointless tumult he had known. Only solitude. Elevated thoughts. Silence. If anything adverse should occur in the next few years, Gilgamesh's cryogenics could be activated by the flip of a switch. Until then, there was a full library of his favorite music and literature and videotapes. He would not be lonely. He had never really been much for company. Yamagishi had considered coming but ultimately reneged. He would be lost, he said, without staff. And on this journey, there were insufficient inducements, as well as inadequate space for staff. The monotony of the food and the modest scale of the amenities might be daunting to some, but Haddon knew himself to be a man with a great dream. The amenities mattered not at all. In 2 years, this flying sarcophagus would fall into the gravitational potential well of Jupiter, just outside its radiation belt, be slingshot around the planet, and then flung off into interstellar space. For a day, he would have a view still more spectacular than that out the window of his study on Methuselah. The roiling, multicolored clouds of Jupiter, the largest planet. If it were only a matter of the view, Haddon would have opted for Saturn and the rings. He preferred the rings, but Saturn was at least 4 years from Earth, and that was, all things considered, taking a chance. If you're stalking immortality, you have to be very careful. At these speeds, it would take 10,000 years to travel even the distance to the nearest star. When you're frozen to 4 degrees above absolute zero, though, you have plenty of time. But some fine day, he was sure of it, though it be a million years from now, Gilgamesh would by chance enter someone else's solar system, or his funeral bark would be intercepted in the darkness between the stars, and other beings very advanced, very far-seeing, would take the sarcophagus aboard and know what had to be done. It had never really been attempted before. No one who ever lived on Earth had come this close. Confident that in his end would be his beginning, he closed his eyes and folded his arms experimentally across his chest, as the engines flared again, this time more briefly, and the burnished craft was sleekly set on its long journey to the stars. Thousands of years from now, God knows what would be happening on Earth, he thought. It was not his problem. It never really had been. But he would be asleep, deep frozen, perfectly preserved, his sarcophagus hurtling through the interstellar void, surpassing the pharaohs, besting Alexander, outshining Quinn. He had contrived his own resurrection. Chapter 23. Reprogramming. We have not followed cunningly devised fables, but were eyewitnesses. 2 Peter 1:16. Look and remember. Look upon this sky, look deep and deep into the sea-clean air, the unconfined, the terminus of prayer. Speak now and speak into the hallowed dome. What do you hear? What does the sky reply? The heavens are taken. This is not your home. Carl J. Shapiro, Travelogue for Exiles. The telephone lines had been repaired. The roads plowed clean, and carefully selected representatives of the world's press were given a brief look at the facility. A few reporters and photographers were taken through the three matching apertures in the Benzels, through the airlock and into the dodec. There were television commentaries recorded, the reporters seated in the chairs that the five had occupied, telling the world of the failure of this first courageous attempt to activate the machine. Ellie and her colleagues were photographed from a distance to show that they were alive and well, but no interviews were to be given just yet. The machine project was taking stock and considering its future options. The tunnel from Honshu to Hokkaido was open again, but the passageway from Earth to Vega was closed. They hadn't actually tested this proposition. Ellie wondered whether, when the five finally left the site, the project would try to spin up the Benzels again. But she believed what she had been told. The machine would not work again. There would be no further access to the tunnels for the beings of Earth. We could make little indentations in space-time as much as we liked. It would do us no good if no one hooked up from the other side. We had been given a glimpse, she thought, and then were left to save ourselves. If we could. In the end, the five were permitted to talk among themselves. She systematically bade farewell to each. No one blamed her for the blank cassettes. All these pictures on the cassettes are recorded in magnetic domains, on tape, Vega reminded her. A strong electrical field accumulated on the Benzels, and they were, of course, moving. A time-varying electrical field makes a magnetic field. Maxwell's equations. It seems to me that's how your tapes were erased. It was not your fault. Vege's interrogation had baffled him. They had not exactly accused him, but merely suggested that he was part of an anti-Soviet conspiracy involving scientists from the West. I tell you, Ellie, the only remaining open question is the existence of intelligent life in the Politburo. And the White House. I can't believe the president would allow Kitz to get away with this. She committed herself to the project. Oh, this planet is run by crazy people. Remember what they have to do to get where they are. Their perspective is so narrow, so brief. A few years, in the best of them, a few decades. They care only about the time they are in power. She thought about Cygnus A. But they are not sure our story is a lie. They cannot prove it. Therefore, we must convince them. In their hearts, they wonder, could it be true? A few even want it to be true, but it is a risky truth. They need something close to certainty. And perhaps we can provide it. We can refine gravitational theory. We can make new astronomical observations to confirm what we were told, especially for the Galactic Center and Cygnus A. They're not going to stop astronomical research. Also, we can study the Dodec if they give us access. Ellie, we will change their minds. Difficult to do if they're all crazy, she thought to herself. I don't see how the governments could convince people this is a hoax, she said. Oh, really? Think of what else they've made people believe. They've persuaded us that we'll be safe if only we spend all our wealth so everybody on Earth can be killed in a moment, when the governments decide the time has come. I would think it's hard to make people believe something so foolish. No, Ellie, they're good at convincing. They need only say that the machine doesn't work and that we've gone a little mad. I don't think we'd seem so mad if we all told our story together. Oh, but you may be right. Maybe we should try to find some evidence first. Vege, will you be okay when you, go back? What can they do to me? Exile me to Gorky? I could survive that. I've had my day at the beach. No, I will be safe. You and I have a mutual security treaty, Ellie. As long as you're alive, they need me. And vice versa, of course. If the story is true, they will be glad there was a Soviet witness. Eventually, they will cry it from the rooftops. And like your people, they will wonder about military and economic uses of what we saw. It doesn't matter what they tell us to do. All that matters is that we stay alive. Then we will tell our story, all five of us. Discreetly, of course. At first, only to those we trust. But those people will tell others. The story will spread. There will be no way to stop it. Sooner or later, the governments will acknowledge what happened to us in the dodecahedron. And until then, we are insurance policies for each other. Ellie, I am very happy about all this. It is the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Give Nina a kiss for me, she said just before he left on the night flight to Moscow. Over breakfast, she asked Xi if he was disappointed. Disappointed? To go there? He lifted his eyes skyward. To see them and to be disappointed? I am an orphan of the Long March. I survived the Cultural Revolution. I was trying to grow potatoes and sugar beets for 6 years in the shadow of the Great Wall. Upheaval has been my whole life. I know disappointment. You have been to a banquet, and when you come home to your starving village, you are disappointed that they do not celebrate your return? Oh, this is no disappointment. We have lost a minor skirmish. Examine the disposition of forces. He would shortly be departing for China, where he had agreed to make no public statements about what had happened in the machine. But he would return to supervise the dig at Xi'an. The tomb of Qin was waiting for him. He wanted to see how closely the Emperor resembled that simulation on the far side of the tunnels. Forgive me. I know this is impertinent, she said after a while. But the fact that of all of us, you alone met someone who... In all your life, wasn't there anyone you loved? She wished she had phrased the question better. Everyone I ever loved was taken from me. Obliterated. I saw the emperors of the 20th century come and go, he answered. I longed for someone who could not be revised, or rehabilitated, or edited out. There are only a few historical figures who cannot be erased. He was looking at the tabletop, fingering the teaspoon. I devoted my life to the revolution, and I have no regrets. But I know almost nothing of my mother and father. I have no memories of them. Your mother is still alive. You remember your father and you found him again. Do not overlook how fortunate you are. In Davy, Ellie sensed a grief she had never before noticed. She assumed it was a reaction to the skepticism with which Project Directorate and the governments had greeted their story. But Davy shook her head. Whether they believe us is not very important for me. The experience itself is central. Transforming? Ellie, that really happened to us. It was real. The first night we were back here on Hokkaido, I dreamt that our experience was a dream, you know? But it wasn't. It wasn't. Yes, I'm sad. My sadness is... You know, I satisfied a lifelong wish up there when I found Surinder again after all these years. He was exactly as I remembered him. Exactly as I've dreamed of him. But when I saw him, when I saw so perfect a simulation, I knew. This love was precious because it had been snatched away. Because I had given up so much to marry him. Nothing more. The man was a fool. 10 years with him and we would have been divorced. Maybe only 5. I was so young and foolish. I'm truly sorry, Ellie said. I know a little about mourning a lost love. Ellie, she replied, you don't understand. For the first time in my adult life, I do not mourn Surinder. What I mourn is the family I renounced for his sake. Sukhavati was returning to Bombay for a few days and then would visit her ancestral village in Tamil Nadu. Eventually, she said, it will be easy to convince ourselves this was only an illusion. Every morning when we wake up, our experience will be more distant, more dreamlike. It would have been better for us all to stay together, to reinforce our memories. They understood this danger. That's why they took us to the seashore, something like our own planet, a reality we can grasp. I will not permit anyone to trivialize this experience. Remember, it really happened. It was not a dream. Ellie, don't forget. Ada was, considering the circumstances, very relaxed. She soon understood why. While she and Vege had been undergoing lengthy interrogations, he had been calculating. I think the tunnels are Einstein-Rosen bridges, he said. General relativity admits a class of solutions called wormholes, similar to black holes, but with no evolutionary connection. They cannot be generated as black holes can by the gravitational collapse of a star. But the usual sort of wormhole once made expands and contracts before anything can cross through. It exerts disastrous tidal forces and it also requires, at least as seen by an observer left behind, an infinite amount of time to get through. Ellie did not see how this represented much progress and asked him to clarify. The key problem was holding the wormhole open. Ada had found a class of solutions to his field equations that suggested a new macroscopic field, a kind of tension that could be used to prevent a wormhole from contracting fully. Such a wormhole would pose none of the other problems of black holes. It would have much smaller tidal stresses, two-way access, quick transit times as measured by an exterior observer, and no devastating interior radiation field. I don't know whether the tunnel is stable against small perturbations, he said. If not, they would have to build a very elaborate feedback system to monitor and correct the instabilities. I'm not yet sure of any of this. But at least if the tunnels can be Einstein-Rosen bridges, we can give some answer when they tell us we were hallucinating. Ada was eager to return to Lagos, and she could see the green ticket of Nigerian Airlines peeking out of his jacket pocket. He wondered if he could completely work through the new physics their experience had implied. But he confessed himself unsure that he would be equal to the task, especially because of what he described as his advanced age for theoretical physics. He was 38. Most of all, he told Ellie, he was desperate to be reunited with his wife and children. She embraced Ada. She told him that she was proud to have known him. Why the past tense? He asked. You will certainly see me again. And Ellie, he added, almost as an afterthought. Will you do something for me? Remember everything that happened, every detail. Write it down and send it to me. Our experience represents experimental data. One of us may have seen some point that the others missed. Something essential for a deep understanding of what happened. Send me what you write. I have asked the others to do the same. He waved, lifted his battered briefcase, and was ushered into the waiting project car. They were departing for their separate nations, and it felt to Ellie as if her own family were being sundered, broken, dispersed. She too had found the experience transforming. How could she not? A demon had been exorcised. Several. And just when she felt more capable of love than she had ever been, she found herself alone. They spirited her out of the facility by helicopter. On the long flight to Washington in the government airplane, she slept so soundly that they had to shake her awake when the White House people came aboard, just after the aircraft landed briefly on an isolated runway at Hickam Field, Hawaii. They had made a bargain. She could go back to Argus, although no longer as director, and pursue any scientific problem she pleased. She had, if she liked, lifetime tenure. "We're not unreasonable," Kitz had finally said in agreeing to the compromise. "You come back with a solid piece of evidence, something really convincing, and we'll join you in making the announcement. We'll say we asked you to keep the story quiet until we could be absolutely sure. Within reason, we'll support any research you want to do. If we announce the story now, though, there'll be an initial wave of enthusiasm, and then the skeptics will start carping. It'll embarrass you, and it'll embarrass us. Much better to gather the evidence if you can." Perhaps the president had helped him change his mind. It was unlikely Kitz was enjoying the compromise. But in return, she must say nothing about what had happened aboard the machine. The five had sat down in the dodecahedron, talked among themselves, and then walked off. If she breathed a word of anything else, the spurious psychiatric profile would find its way to the media, and reluctantly she would be dismissed. She wondered whether they had attempted to buy Peter Valerian's silence or Vegas or Abonema's. She couldn't see how, short of shooting the debriefing teams of five nations and the World Machine Consortium, they could hope to keep this quiet forever. It was only a matter of time. So, she concluded, they were buying time. It surprised her how mild the threatened punishments were, but violations of the agreement, if they happened, would not come on Kitz's watch. He was shortly retiring. In a year, the Lasker administration would be leaving office after the constitutionally mandated maximum of 2 terms. He had accepted a partnership in a Washington law firm known for its defense contractor clientele. Ellie thought Kitz would attempt something more. He seemed unworried about anything she might claim occurred at the Galactic Center. What he agonized about, she was sure, was the possibility that the tunnel was still open to, even if not from, the Earth. She thought the Hokkaido facility would soon be disassembled. The technicians would return to their industries and universities. What stories would they tell? Perhaps the dodecahedron would be displayed in the science city of Tsukuba. Then, after a decent interval when the world's attention was to some extent distracted by other matters, perhaps there would be an explosion at the machine site. Nuclear, if Kitz could contrive a plausible explanation for the event. If it was a nuclear explosion, the radiological contamination would be an excellent reason to declare the whole area a forbidden zone. It would at least isolate the site from casual observers and might just shake the nozzle loose. Probably Japanese sensibilities about nuclear weapons, even if exploded underground, would force Kitz to settle for conventional explosives. They might disguise it as one of the continuing series of Hokkaido coal mine disasters. She doubted if any explosion, nuclear or conventional, could disengage the Earth from the tunnel. But perhaps Kitz was imagining none of these things. Perhaps she was selling him short. After all, he too must have been influenced by Machindo. He must have a family, friends, someone he loved. He must have caught at least a whiff of it. The next day, the president awarded her the National Medal of Freedom in a public ceremony at the White House. Logs were burning in a fireplace set in a white marble wall. The president had committed a great deal of political, as well as the more usual sort of capital to the machine project, and was determined to make the best face of it before the nation and the world. Investments in the machine by the United States and other nations, the argument went, had paid off handsomely. New technologies, new industries were blossoming, promising at least as much benefit for ordinary people as the inventions of Thomas Edison. We had discovered that we are not alone, that intelligences more advanced than we existed out there in space. They had changed forever, the president said, our conception of who we are. Speaking for herself, but also, she thought, for most Americans, the discovery had strengthened her belief in God, now revealed to be creating life and intelligence on many worlds, a conclusion that the president was sure would be in harmony with all religions. But the greatest good granted us by the machine, the president said, was the spirit it had brought to Earth, the increasing mutual understanding within the human community, the sense that we were all fellow passengers on a perilous journey in space and in time, the goal of a global unity of purpose that was now known all over the planet as Machindo. The president presented Ellie to the press and the television cameras, told of her perseverance over 12 long years, her genius in detecting and decoding the message, and her courage in going aboard the machine. No one knew what the machine would do. Dr. Arroway had willingly risked her life. It was not Dr. Arroway's fault that nothing happened when the machine was activated. She had done as much as any human possibly could. She deserved the thanks of all Americans and of all people everywhere on Earth. Ellie was a very private person. Despite her natural reticence, she had, when the need arose, shouldered the burden of explaining the message and the machine. Indeed, she had shown a patience with the press that she, the president, admired particularly. Dr. Arroway should now be permitted some real privacy, so she could resume her scientific career. There had been press announcements, briefings, interviews with Secretary Kitts and science advisor Duhier. The president hoped the press would respect Dr. Arroway's wish that there be no press conference. There was, however, a photo opportunity. Ellie left Washington without determining how much the president knew. They flew her back in a small, sleek jet of the Joint Military Airlift Command and agreed to stop in Janesville on the way. Her mother was wearing her old quilted robe. Someone had put a little color on her cheeks. Ellie pressed her face into the pillow beside her mother. Beyond regaining a halting power of speech, the old woman had recovered the use of her right arm sufficiently to give Ellie a few feeble pats on her shoulder. Mom, I've got something to tell you. It's a great thing. But try to be calm. I don't want to upset you. Mom, I saw Dad. I saw him. He sends you his love. Yes. The old woman slowly nodded. Was here yesterday. John Stoughton, Ellie knew, had been to the nursing home the previous day. He had begged off accompanying Ellie today, pleading an excess of work, but it seemed possible that Stoughton merely did not wish to intrude on this moment. Nevertheless, she found herself saying with some irritation, No, I'm talking about Dad. Tell him. The old woman's speech was labored. Tell him. Chiffon dress. Stop cleaners. Way home from store. Her father evidently still ran the hardware store in her mother's universe. And Ellie's. The long sweep of cyclone fencing now stretched uselessly from horizon to horizon, blighting the expanse of scrub desert. She was glad to be back, glad to be setting up a new, although much smaller scale, research program. Jack Hibbert had been appointed acting director of the Argus facility, and she felt unburdened of the administrative responsibilities. Because so much telescope time had been freed when the signal from Vega had ceased, there was a heady air of progress in a dozen long-languishing subdisciplines of radio astronomy. Her co-workers offered not a hint of support for Kitts's notion of a message hoax. She wondered what Duhier and Valerian were telling their friends and colleagues about the message and the machine. Ellie doubted that Kitz had breathed a word of it outside the recesses of his soon-to-be-vacated Pentagon office. She had been there once. A Navy enlisted man, sidearm in leather holster and hands clasped behind his back, had stiffly guarded the portal, in case, in the whirr of concentric hallways, some passerby should succumb to an irrational impulse. Willie had himself driven the Thunderbird from Wyoming, so it would be waiting for her. By agreement, she could drive it only on the facility, which was large enough for ordinary joyriding. But no more West Texas landscapes. No more Coney honor guards. No more mountain drives to glimpse a southern star. This was her sole regret about the seclusion. But the ranks of saluting rabbits were at any rate unavailable in winter. At first, a sizable press corps haunted the area in hopes of shouting a question at her or photographing her through a telescopic lens. But she remained resolutely isolated. The newly imported public relations staff was effective, even a little ruthless in discouraging inquiries. After all, the president had asked for privacy for Dr. Arroway. Over the following weeks and months, the battalion of reporters dwindled to a company and then to a platoon. Now only a squad of the most steadfast remained, mostly from the World Hologram and other sensationalist weekly newspapers, the Killiest magazines, and a lone representative from a publication that called itself Science and God. No one knew what sect it belonged to, and its reporter wasn't telling. When the stories were written, they told of 12 years of dedicated work, culminating in the momentous, triumphant decryption of the message, and followed by the construction of the machine. At the peak of world expectation, it had sadly failed. The machine had gone nowhere. Naturally, Dr. Arroway was disappointed. Maybe, they speculated, even a little depressed. Many editorialists commented that this pause was welcome. The pace of new discovery and the evident need for major philosophical and religious reassessments represented so heady a mix that a time of retrenchment and slow reappraisal was needed. Perhaps the Earth was not yet ready for contact with alien civilizations. Sociologists and some educators claimed that the mere existence of extraterrestrial intelligences more advanced than we would require several generations to be properly assimilated. It was a body blow to human self-esteem, they said. There was enough on our plate already. In another few decades, we would much better understand the principles underlying the machine. We would see what mistake we had made, and we would laugh at how trivial an oversight had prevented it from functioning in its first full trial back in 1999. Some religious commentators argued that the failure of the machine was a punishment for the sin of pride, for human arrogance. Billy Joe Rankin, in a nationwide television address, proposed that the message had in fact come straight from a hell called Vega, an authoritative consolidation of his previous positions on the matter. The message and the machine, he said, were a latter-day Tower of Babel. Humans, foolishly, tragically, had aspired to reach the throne of God. There had been a city of fornication and blasphemy built thousands of years ago called Babylon, which God had destroyed. In our time, there was another such city with the same name. Those dedicated to the word of God had fulfilled his purpose there as well. The message and the machine represented still another assault of wickedness upon the righteous and God-fearing. Here again, the demonic initiatives had been forestalled. In Wyoming, by a divinely inspired accident. In godless Russia, through the confounding of communist scientists by the divine grace. But despite these clear warnings of God's will, Rankin continued, humans had for a third time tried to build the machine. God let them. Then gently, subtly, he caused the machine to fail, deflected the demonic intent, and once more demonstrated his care and concern for his wayward and sinful, if truth be told, his unworthy children on earth. It was time to learn the lessons of our sinfulness, our abominations, and before the coming millennium, the real millennium that would begin on January the 1st, 2001, rededicate our planet and ourselves to God. The machines should be destroyed, every last one of them and all their parts. the pretense that by building a machine rather than by purifying their hearts, humans could stand at the right hand of God must be expunged, root and branch, before it was too late. In her little apartment, Ellie heard Rankin out, turned off the television set, and resumed her programming. The only outside calls she was permitted were to the rest home in Janesville, Wisconsin. All incoming calls, except from Janesville, were screened out. Polite apologies were provided. Letters from Derheer, Valerian, from her old college friend, Becky Ellenbogen, she filed unopened. There were a number of messages delivered by express mail services, and then by courier, from South Carolina, from Palmer Joss. She was much more tempted to read these, but did not. She wrote him a note that read only, "Dear Palmer, not yet. Ellie," and posted it with no return address. She had no way to know if it would be delivered. A television special on her life, made without her consent, described her as more reclusive now than Neil Armstrong or even Greta Garbo. Ellie took it all with cheerful equanimity. She was otherwise occupied. Indeed, she was working night and day. The prohibitions on communication with the outside world did not extend to purely scientific collaboration, and through open-channel, asynchronous telenetting, she and Vege organized a long-term research program. Among the objects to be examined were the vicinity of Sagittarius A at the center of the galaxy, and the great extragalactic radio source, Cygnus A. The Argus telescopes were employed as part of a phased array linked with the Soviet telescopes in Samarkand. Together, the American-Soviet array acted as if they were part of a single radio telescope the size of the Earth. Operating at a wavelength of a few centimeters, they could resolve sources of radio emission as small as the inner solar system if they were as far away as the center of the galaxy. She worried that this was not good enough, that the two orbiting black holes were considerably smaller than that. Still, a continuous monitoring program might turn up something. What they really needed, she thought, was a radio telescope launched by space vehicle to the other side of the sun, and working in tandem with radio telescopes on Earth. Humans could thereby create a telescope effectively the size of the Earth's orbit. With it, she calculated, they could resolve something the size of the Earth at the center of the galaxy, or maybe the size of the station. She spent most of her time writing, modifying existing programs for the Cray-21, and setting down an account, as detailed as she possibly could make it, of the salient events that had been squeezed into the 20 minutes of Earth time after they activated the machine. Halfway through, she realized she was writing Samizdat, typewriter and carbon paper technology. She locked the original and two copies in her safe, beside a yellowing copy of the Haddon decision, secreted the third copy behind a loose plank in the electronics bay of Telescope 49, and burned the carbon paper. It generated a black, acrid smoke. In 6 weeks, she had finished reprogramming, and just as her thoughts returned to Palmer Joss, he presented himself at the Argus front gate. His way had been cleared by a few phone calls from a special assistant to the president, with whom, of course, Joss had been acquainted for years. Even here in the Southwest, with its casual sartorial codes, he wore, as always, a jacket, a white shirt, and a tie. She gave him the palm frond, thanked him for the pendant, and despite all of Kitz's admonitions to keep her delusional experience quiet, immediately told him everything. They adopted the practice of her Soviet colleagues, who, whenever anything politically unorthodox needed to be said, discovered the urgent necessity for a brisk walk. Every now and then he would stop, and a distant observer would see lean toward her. Each time she would take his arm, and they would walk on. He listened sympathetically, intelligently, indeed generously, especially for someone whose doctrines must, she thought, be challenged at their fundaments by her account, if he gave them any credence at all. After all his reluctance at the time the message had first been received, at last she was showing Argus to him. He was companionable, and she found herself happy to see him. She wished she had been less preoccupied when she had seen him last in Washington. Apparently at random, they climbed up the narrow metal exterior stairways that straddled the base of Telescope 49. The vista of 130 radio telescopes, most of them rolling stock on their own set of railway tracks, was like nothing else on Earth. In the electronics bay, she slid back the plank and retrieved a bulky envelope with Joss's name upon it. He put it in his inside breast pocket, where it made a discernible bulge. She told him about the SAG-A and SIG-A observing protocols. She told him about her computer program. It's very time-consuming, even with the Cray, to calculate pi out to something like 10 to the 20th place. And we don't know that what we're looking for is in pi. They sort of said it wasn't. It might be E. It might be one of the family of transcendental numbers they told Vega about. It might be some altogether different number. So a simple-minded brute force approach, just calculating fashionable transcendental numbers forever, is a waste of time. But here at Argus, we have very sophisticated decryption algorithms, designed to find patterns in a signal, designed to pull out and display anything that looks non-random. So I rewrote the programs. From the expression on his face, she was afraid she had not been clear. She made a small swerve in the monologue. But not to calculate the digits in a number like pi, print them out and present them for inspection. Oh, there isn't enough time for that. Instead, the program races through the digits in pi and pauses even to think about it only when there's some anomalous sequence of zeros and ones. You know what I'm saying? Something non-random. By chance, there'll be some zeros and ones, of course. 10% of the digits will be zeros, and another 10% will be ones, on average. The more digits we race through, the longer the sequences of pure zeros and ones that we should get by accident. The program knows what's expected statistically and only pays attention to unexpectedly long sequences of zeros and ones. And it doesn't only look in base 10. Oh, I don't understand. If you look at enough random numbers, won't you get any pattern you want simply by chance? Sure. But you can calculate how likely that is. If you get a very complex message very early on, you know it can't be by chance. So every day in the early hours of the morning, the computer works on this problem. No data from the outside world goes in. And so far, no data from the inside world comes out. It just runs through the optimum series expansion for pi and watches the digits fly. It minds its own business. Unless it finds something, it doesn't speak unless it's spoken to. It's sort of contemplating its navel. I'm no mathematician, God knows, but could you give me a for instance? Sure. She searched in the pockets of her jumpsuit for a piece of paper and could find none. She thought about reaching into his inside breast pocket, retrieving the envelope she had just given him and writing on it, but decided that was too risky out here in the open. After a moment, he understood and produced a small spiral notebook. Thanks. Pi starts out 3.1415926. You can see that the digits vary pretty randomly. Okay, a 1 appears twice in the first 4 digits, but after you keep on going for a while, it averages out. Each digit, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, appears almost exactly 10% of the time when you've accumulated enough digits. Occasionally, you'll get a few consecutive digits that are the same, 4444, for example, but not more than you'd expect statistically. Now, suppose you're running merrily through these digits and suddenly you find nothing but fours, hundreds of fours all in a row. That couldn't carry any information, but it also couldn't be a statistical fluke. You could calculate the digits in pi for the age of the universe, and if the digits are random, you'd never go deep enough to get 100 consecutive fours. It's like the search you did for the message with these radio telescopes. Yes, in both cases we were looking for a signal that's well out of the noise, something that can't be just a statistical fluke. But it doesn't have to be 100 fours, is that right? It could speak to us. Sure. Imagine after a while we get a long sequence of just zeros and ones. Then, just as we did with the message, we could pull a picture out, if there's one in there. You understand, it could be anything. You mean you could decode a picture hiding in pi and it would be a mess of Hebrew letters? Sure, big black letters carved in stone. He looked at her quizzically. Forgive me, Eleanor, but don't you think you're being a mite too indirect? You don't belong to a silent order of Buddhist nuns. Why don't you just tell your story? Palmer, if I had hard evidence, I'd speak up. But if I don't have any, people like Kitz will say that I'm lying or hallucinating. That's why that manuscript's in your inside pocket. You're going to seal it, date it, notarize it, and put it in a safety deposit box. If anything happens to me, you can release it to the world. I give you full authority to do anything you want with it. And if nothing happens to you? If nothing happens to me? Then, when we find what we're looking for, that manuscript will confirm our story. If we find evidence of a double black hole at the galactic center, or some huge artificial construction in Cygnus A, or a message hiding inside Pi, this, she tapped him lightly on the chest, will be my evidence. Then I'll speak out. Meantime, don't lose it. I still don't understand, he confessed. We know there's a mathematical order to the universe, the law of gravity and all that. How is this different? So there's order inside the digits of Pi, so what? No, don't you see? This would be different. This isn't just starting the universe out with some precise mathematical laws that determine physics and chemistry. This is a message. Whoever makes the universe hides messages in transcendental numbers, so they'll be read 15 billion years later when intelligent life finally evolves. I criticized you and Rankin the time we first met for not understanding this. If God wanted us to know that he existed, why didn't he send us an unambiguous message, I asked. Remember? I remember very well. You think God is a mathematician? Something like that. If what we're told is true, if this isn't a wild goose chase, if there's a message hiding in Pi, and not one of the infinity of other transcendental numbers, that's a lot of ifs. You're looking for revelation in arithmetic. I know a better way. Palmer, this is the only way. This is the only thing that would convince a skeptic. Imagine we find something. It doesn't have to be tremendously complicated. Just something more orderly than could accumulate by chance that many digits into Pi. That's all we need. Then mathematicians all over the world can find exactly the same pattern or message or whatever it proves to be. Then there are no sectarian divisions. Everybody begins reading the same scripture. No one could then argue that the key miracle in their religion was some conjurer's trick, or that later historians had falsified the record, or that it's just hysteria or delusion or a substitute parent for when we grow up. Everyone could be a believer. You can't be sure you'll find anything. You can hide here and compute till the cows come home. Or you can go out and tell your story to the world. Sooner or later, you'll have to choose. I'm hoping I won't have to choose, Palmer. First the physical evidence, then the public announcements. Otherwise, don't you see how vulnerable we'd be? I don't mean for myself, but... He shook his head almost imperceptibly. A smile was playing at the corners of his lips. He had detected a certain irony in their circumstances. Why are you so eager for me to tell my story? She asked. Perhaps he took it for a rhetorical question. At any rate, he did not respond, and she continued. Don't you think there's been a strange, reversal of our positions? Here I am, the bearer of the profound religious experience I can't prove. Really, Palmer, I can barely fathom it. And here you are, the hardened skeptic trying, more successfully than I ever did, to be kind to the credulous. Oh no, Eleanor, he said, I'm not a skeptic. I'm a believer. Are you? The story I have to tell isn't exactly about punishment and reward. It's not exactly Advent and rapture. There's not a word in it about Jesus. Part of my message is that we're not central to the purpose of the cosmos. What happened to me makes us all seem very small. It does. But it also makes God very big. She glanced at him for a moment and rushed on. You know, as the earth races around the sun, the powers of this world, the religious powers, the secular powers, once pretended the earth wasn't moving at all. They were in the business of being powerful, or at least pretending to be powerful. And the truth made them feel too small. The truth frightened them, It undermined their power. So they suppressed it. Those people found the truth dangerous. You're sure you know what believing me entails? I've been searching, Eleanor. After all these years, believe me, I know the truth when I see it. Any faith that admires truth, that strives to know God, must be brave enough to accommodate the universe. I mean the real universe. All those light years, all those worlds. I think of the scope of your universe, the opportunities it affords the Creator, and it takes my breath away. It's much better than bottling him up in one small world. I never liked the idea of Earth as God's green footstool. It was too reassuring, like a children's story, like a tranquilizer. But your universe has room enough and time enough for the kind of God I believe in. I say you don't need any more proof. There are proofs enough already. Cygnus A and all that are just for the scientists. You think it'll be hard to convince ordinary people that you're telling the truth? I think it'll be easy as pie. You think your story is too peculiar, too alien? But I've heard it before. I know it well. And I bet you do too. He closed his eyes and after a moment recited, "He dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. Surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. This is none other but the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." He had been a little carried away, as if preaching to the multitudes from the pulpit of a great cathedral, and when he opened his eyes, it was with a small self-deprecatory smile. They walked down a vast avenue, flanked left and right by enormous whitewashed radio telescopes, straining at the sky. And after a moment, he spoke in a more conversational tone. "Your story has been foretold. It's happened before. Somewhere inside of you, you must have known. None of your details are in the book of Genesis." "Of course not. How could they be? The Genesis account was right for the time of Jacob, just as your witness is right for this time, for our time. People are going to believe you, Eleanor. Millions of them all over the world. I know it for certain." She shook her head, and they walked on for another moment in silence before he continued. "All right, then. I understand. You take as much time as you have to. But if there's any way to hurry it up, do it. For my sake. We have less than a year to the millennium." "I understand also. Bear with me a few more months. If we haven't found something in Pi by then, I'll consider going public with what happened up there. Before January 1st. Maybe Ada and the others would be willing to speak out also. Okay?" They walked in silence back toward the Argus administration building. The sprinklers were watering the meager lawn, and they stepped around a puddle that on this parched earth seemed alien, out of place. "Have you ever been married?" he asked. "No, I never have. I guess I've been too busy." "Ever been in love?" The question was direct, matter of fact. "Halfway, half a dozen times, but..." She glanced at the nearest telescope. There was always so much noise. The signal was hard to find. "And you?" "Never," he replied flatly. There was a pause, and then he added with a faint smile, "But I have faith." She decided not to pursue this ambiguity just yet, and they mounted the short flight of stairs to examine the Argus mainframe computer. Chapter 24. The Artist's Signature. "Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed." 1 Corinthians 15:51. The universe seems to have been determined and ordered in accordance with number, by the forethought and the mind of the Creator of all things, for the pattern was fixed, like a preliminary sketch, by the domination of number pre-existent in the mind of the world-creating God. Nicomachus of Gerasa. Arithmetic 1, 6, circa AD 100. She rushed up the steps of the nursing home, and on the newly repainted green veranda, marked off at regular intervals by empty rocking chairs, she saw John Stoughton, stooped, immobile, his arms dead weights. In his right hand, he clutched a shopping bag in which Ellie could see a translucent shower cap, a flowered makeup case, and two bedroom slippers adorned with pink pom-poms. "She's gone," he said as his eyes focused. "Don't go in," he pleaded. "Don't look at her. She would have hated for you to see her like this. You know how much pride she took in her appearance. Anyway, she's not in there." Almost reflexively, out of long practice and still unresolved resentments, Ellie was tempted to turn and enter anyway. Was she prepared even now to defy him as a matter of principle? What was the principle exactly? From the havoc on his face, there was no question about the authenticity of his remorse. He had loved her mother. Maybe she thought he loved her more than I did, and a wave of self-reproach swept through her. Her mother had been so frail for so long that Ellie had tested many times how she would respond when the moment came. She remembered how beautiful her mother had been in the picture that Stoughton had sent her. And suddenly, despite her rehearsals for this moment, she was racked with sobs. Startled by her distress, Stoughton moved to comfort her, but she put up a hand and with a visible effort regained her self-control. Even now, she could not bring herself to embrace him. They were strangers, tenuously linked by a corpse. But she had been wrong. She knew it in the depths of her being to have blamed Stoughton for her father's death. "I have something for you," he said as he fumbled in the shopping bag. Some of the contents circulated between top and bottom, and she could see now an imitation leather wallet and a plastic denture case. She had to look away. At last he straightened up, flourishing a weather-beaten envelope. "For Eleanor," it read. Recognizing her mother's handwriting, she moved to take it. Stoughton took a startled step backward, raising the envelope in front of his face as if she had been about to strike him. "Wait," he said. "Wait. I know we've never gotten along, but do me this one favor. Don't read the letter until tonight, okay?" In his grief, he seemed a decade older. "Why?" she asked. "Your favorite question. Just do me this one courtesy. Is it too much to ask?" "You're right," she said. "It's not too much to ask. I'm sorry." He looked her directly in the eye. "Whatever happened to you in that machine," he said. "Maybe it changed you." "I hope so, John." She called Joss and asked him if he would perform the funeral service. "I don't have to tell you I'm not religious, but there were times when my mother was. You're the only person I can think of whom I'd want to do it, and I'm pretty sure my stepfather will approve." "He would be there on the next plane," Joss assured her. In her hotel room after an early dinner, she fingered the envelope, caressing every fold and scuff. It was old. Her mother must have written it years ago, carrying it around in some compartment of her purse, debating with herself whether to give it to Ellie. It did not seem newly resealed, and Ellie wondered whether Stoughton had read it. Part of her hungered to open it, and part of her hung back with a kind of foreboding. She sat for a long time in the musty armchair thinking, her knees drawn up limberly against her chin. A chime sounded, and the not quite noiseless carriage of her telefax came to life. It was linked to the Argus computer. Although it reminded her of the old days, there was no real urgency. Whatever the computer had found was not about to go away. Pi would not set as the earth turned. If there was a message hiding inside Pi, it would wait for her forever. She examined the envelope again, but the echo of the chime intruded. If there was content inside a transcendental number, it could only have been built into the geometry of the universe from the beginning. This new project of hers was in experimental theology. But So is all of science, she thought. Stand by, the computer printed out on the telefax screen. She thought of her father. Well, the simulacrum of her father. About the caretakers with their network of tunnels through the galaxy. They had witnessed and perhaps influenced the origin and development of life on millions of worlds. They were building galaxies, closing off sectors of the universe. They could manage at least a limited kind of time travel. They were gods beyond the pious imaginings of almost all religions, all Western religions anyway. But even they had their limitations. They had not built the tunnels and were unable to do so. They had not inserted the message into the transcendental number and could not even read it. The tunnel builders and the pie inscribers were somebody else. They didn't live here anymore. They had left no forwarding address. When the tunnel builders had departed, she guessed, those who would eventually be the caretakers had become abandoned children. Like her. Like her. She thought about Ada's hypothesis that the tunnels were wormholes, distributed at convenient intervals around innumerable stars in this and other galaxies. They resembled black holes, but they had different properties and different origins. They were not exactly massless, because she had seen them leave gravitational wakes in the orbiting debris in the Vega system. And through them, beings and ships of many kinds traversed and bound up the galaxy. Wormholes. In the revealing jargon of theoretical physics, the universe was their apple, and someone had tunneled through, riddling the interior with passageways that crisscrossed the core. For a bacillus who lived on the surface, it was a miracle. But a being standing outside the apple might be less impressed. From that perspective, the tunnel builders were only an annoyance. But if the tunnel builders are worms, she thought, who are we? The Argus computer had gone deep into Pi, deeper than anyone on Earth, human or machine, had ever gone, although not nearly so deep as the caretakers had ventured. This was much too soon, she thought, to be the long, undecrypted message about which Theodore Arroway had told her on the shores of that uncharted sea. Maybe this was just a gearing up, a preview of coming attractions, an encouragement to further exploration, a token so humans would not lose heart. Whatever it was, it could not possibly be the message the caretakers were struggling with. Maybe there were easy messages and hard messages, locked away in the various transcendental numbers, and the Argus computer had found the easiest, with help. At the station, she had learned a kind of humility, a reminder of how little the inhabitants of Earth really knew. There might, she thought, be as many categories of beings more advanced than humans as there are between us and the ants, or maybe even between us and the viruses. But it had not depressed her. Rather than a daunting resignation, it had aroused in her a swelling sense of wonder. There was so much more to aspire to now. It was like the step from high school to college, from everything coming effortlessly, to the necessity of making a sustained and disciplined effort to understand it all. In high school, she had grasped her coursework more quickly than almost anybody. In college, she had discovered many people much quicker than she. There had been the same sense of incremental difficulty and challenge when she entered graduate school, and when she became a professional astronomer. At every stage, she had found scientists more accomplished than she, and each stage had been more exciting than the last. Let the revelations roll, she thought, looking at the telefax. She was ready. Transmission problem. S/N greater than 10. Please stand by. She was linked to the Argus computer by a communications relay satellite called DEFCOM Alpha. Perhaps there had been an attitude control problem, or a programming foul-up. Before she could think about it further, she found she had opened the envelope. Arroway Hardware, the letterhead said, and sure enough, the type font was that of the old Royal her father had kept at home to do both business and personal accounts. June 13, 1964, was typed in the upper right-hand corner. She had been 15 then. Her father could not have written it. He had been dead for years. A glance at the bottom of the page confirmed the neat hand of her mother. My sweet Ellie, now that I'm dead, I hope you can find it in your heart to forgive me. I know I committed a sin against you, and not just you. I couldn't bear how you'd hate me if you knew the truth. That's why I didn't have the courage to tell you while I was alive. I know how much you love Ted Arroway, and I want you to know I did too. I still do. But he wasn't your real father. Your real father is John Stoughton. I did something very wrong. I shouldn't have, and I was weak. But if I hadn't, you wouldn't be in the world, so please be kind when you think about me. Ted knew, and he gave me forgiveness, and we said we'd never tell you. But I look out the window right now, and I see you in the backyard. You're sitting there thinking about stars and things that I never could understand, and I'm so proud of you. You make such a point about the truth. I thought it was right that you should know this truth about yourself. Your beginning, I mean. If John is still alive, then he's given you this letter. I know he'll do it. He's a better man than you think he is, Ellie. I was lucky to find him again. Maybe you hate him so much because something inside of you figured out the truth. But really, you hate him because he isn't Theodore Arroway. I know. There you are, still sitting out there. You haven't moved since I started this letter. You're just thinking. I hope and pray that whatever you're seeking, you'll find. Forgive me. I was only human. Love, Mom. Ellie had assimilated the letter in a single gulp and immediately read it again. She had difficulty breathing. Her hands were clammy. The imposter had turned out to be the real thing. For most of her life, she had rejected her own father without the vaguest notion of what she was doing. What strength of character he had shown during all those adolescent outbursts when she taunted him for not being her father, for having no right to tell her what to do. The telefax chimed again twice. It was now inviting her to press the return key, but she did not have the will to go to it. It would have to wait. She thought of of Theodore Arroway, and John Stoughton, and her mother. They had sacrificed much for her, and she had been too self-involved even to notice. She wished Palmer were with her. The telefax chimed once more and the carriage moved, tentatively, experimentally. She had programmed the computer to be persistent, even a little innovative, in attracting her attention if it thought it had found something in Pi. But she was much too busy undoing and reconstructing the mythology of her life. Her mother would have been sitting at the desk in the big bedroom upstairs, glancing out the window as she wondered how to phrase the letter, and her eye had rested on Ellie at age 15, awkward, resentful, rebellious. Her mother had given her another gift. With this letter, Ellie had cycled back and come upon herself all those years ago. She had learned so much since then. There was so much more to learn. Above the table on which the chattering telefax sat was a mirror. In it she saw a woman neither young nor old, neither mother nor daughter. They had been right to keep the truth from her. She was not sufficiently advanced to receive that signal, much less decrypt it. She had spent her career attempting to make contact with the most remote and alien of strangers, while in her own life she had made contact with hardly anyone at all. She had been fierce in debunking the creation myths of others, and oblivious to the lie at the core of her own. She had studied the universe all her life, but had overlooked its clearest message. For small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love. The Argus computer was so persistent and inventive in its attempts to contact Eleanor Arroway that it almost conveyed an urgent personal need to share the discovery. The anomaly showed up most starkly in base 11 arithmetic, where it could be written out entirely as zeros and ones. Compared with what had been received from Vega, this could be at best a simple message, but its statistical significance was high. The program reassembled the digits into a square raster, an equal number across and down. The first line was an uninterrupted file of zeros, left to right. The second line showed a single numeral one, exactly in the middle, with zeros to the borders left and right. After a few more lines, an unmistakable arc had formed, composed of ones. The simple geometrical figure had been quickly constructed line by line, self-reflexive, rich with promise. The last line of the figure emerged, all zeros except for a single centered one. The subsequent line would be zeros only, part of the frame. Hiding in the alternating patterns of digits, deep inside the transcendental number was a perfect circle, its form traced out by unities in a field of knots. "The universe was made on purpose," the circle said. "In whatever galaxy you happen to find yourself, you take the circumference of a circle, divide it by its diameter, measure closely enough, and uncover a miracle. Another circle, drawn kilometers downstream of the decimal point. There would be richer messages farther in. It doesn't matter what you look like, or what you're made of, or where you come from. As long as you live in this universe, and have a modest talent for mathematics, sooner or later you'll find it. It's already here. It's inside everything. You don't have to leave your planet to find it. In the fabric of space, and in the nature of matter, as in a great work of art, there is written small the artist's signature. Standing over humans, gods and demons, subsuming caretakers and tunnel builders, there is an intelligence that antedates the universe." The circle had closed. She found what she had been searching for.
This has been a presentation of BBC Audiobooks America. Contact. Text copyright 1985 by Carl Sagan. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2001 by BBC Audiobooks America. This audiobook has been recorded and published under license from Simon & Schuster Audio, which reserves all rights of reproduction or other use.